Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we are reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to check in with the royals. We're going to check in with Hollywood, and then we're going to get into the politics section. We're going to start with a comeback, although it says don't call it a comeback. Ellen DeGeneres returns to stand-up, says she became the most hated person in America. This is by Chris Murphy, published on April 26th. Ellen DeGeneres is dancing her way back into the public eye. After about 2 years out of the spotlight amid toxic workplace allegations on her daytime talk show, The Ellen DeGeneres Show, she performed a stand-up at Largo in Los Angeles on Wednesday, April 24th, and addressed how she was kicked out of show business for being mean, according to People magazine. In June of 2020, DeGeneres was the subject of a BuzzFeed News article that alleged that producers and managers on the Emmy-winning Ellen DeGeneres Show had fostered a toxic workplace, with DeGeneres, who ended every show with the message, "Be kind," at the helm. At the time, DeGeneres apologized to staff and later, on camera, and three senior staff members, head writer Kevin Lehman, and executive producers Ed Glavin and Jonathan Norman, left the show. In the aftermath of the allegations, the show hemorrhaged viewers. DeGeneres announced in May of 2021 that her show would be coming to an end after 19 seasons. DeGeneres reportedly said that her new comedy show, Ellen's Last Stand, Up Tour, would be taped for a Netflix special. Per Rolling Stone, DeGeneres did not beat around the bush during her Wednesday performance. "I've been kicked out of show business," she reportedly quipped. "There's no mean people in show business." She also joked that she became the most hated person in America because of the allegations. "The hate went on for a long time, and I would try to avoid looking at the news," she said, according to People. "The Be Kind girl wasn't kind." That was the headline. Part of the problem, DeGeneres added, was that she painted herself into a corner with her public persona. She said that she became a one-dimensional character who gave stuff away and danced up steps. After the show, DeGeneres took questions from the audience and further opened up about that period of her life. She said that her fall from grace didn't only affect her, it also negatively impacted her wife, Portia de Rossi. "She was watching it happen to me," DeGeneres reportedly told the audience. "She went through it with me." When asked if she continued to dance after the show went off air, DeGeneres responded, "No, it's hard to dance when you're crying." During the scandal, DeGeneres admitted she had a hard time and didn't get out much. As for how her show concluded, she said that she hated the way the show ended because she loved that show so much. "I'm making jokes about what happened to me, but it was devastating," she said. "It took a long time for me to want to do anything again." DeGeneres noted that this was not the first time she was excommunicated from Hollywood, citing the cancellation of her sitcom, Ellen, in the 90s, shortly after she came out as a lesbian. "For those of you keeping score, this is the second time I've been kicked out of show business," she said. "Eventually, they're going to kick me out for a third time because I'm mean, old, and gay." Although she spent most of the past few years out of the spotlight, DeGeneres has kept busy. She's been focused on the Gorilla Conservation Campus that was founded in her honor in Rwanda, and she reportedly told the audience Wednesday that she spent a lot of time gardening as well as adopting pet chickens. "But she admitted that the past few years have been such a toll on my ego and my self-esteem. There's such extremes in this business. People either love you and idolize you or they hate you. And those people somehow are louder," she said. "But it looks like DeGeneres believes that the worst in the past is over. I am dancing now," she said. Moving to a little bit of royal news, Prince Harry gives out a Soldier of the Year award to a friend he made through the Invictus Games. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof, published on April 26th. This week, Prince Harry gave an honor to a friend who is also one of the Invictus Games' biggest success stories. In a video message, the prince appeared at the Military Times Service Member of the Year Awards, where he presented the prestigious Soldier of the Year title to Sergeant First Class Elizabeth Marks. Marks, a combat medic, was injured in Iraq in 2010 before eventually returning to active duty and becoming internationally recognized as a para swimmer. In a video filmed in the Montecito home he shares with Meghan Markle, Harry donned his military medals to explain that he first connected with Marks because of the Games, which were founded in 2014 to support the rehabilitation of wounded service members. I first met Sergeant First Class Elizabeth Marks at the Invictus Games in Orlando, 2016, where I presented her with not one, but four gold medals that she'd won in swimming, he said. To me, she epitomizes the courage, resilience, and determination represented across our service community, and this is not just because of her swimming abilities. After her success at the 2016 Games, Marks went on to be recognized for her skills in the pool at two Paralympic Games, where she netted five medals, and has now become the most decorated athlete in the history of the U.S. Army World Class Athlete Program. Harry also told the story of Mark's journey to sports after her battlefield injury. Ellie has courageously overcome every obstacle to cross her path. She has turned her pain into purpose and led through compassion and willpower, showing others that the impossible is indeed possible, Harry said. Despite the injuries she endured during her deployment as a medical assistant in Iraq, along with numerous surgeries and setbacks that would have deterred many, she has persevered tirelessly, becoming the first woman in the Army's world-class athlete program, as well as the first swimmer in the program had ever seen. This year marks 10 years since the Invictus Games Foundation was established, and to celebrate the milestone, the charity is holding a service of thanksgiving at St. Paul's Cathedral in London on May 8th. Harry was reportedly considering making the trip across the pond to attend the event, but his participation has not been confirmed. And the oldest royal, King Charles, will return to royal duties with a visit to a cancer center. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof, also published on the 26th. Nearly 3 months after announcing a cancer diagnosis, King Charles III is getting ready to return to royal duties. On Friday, Buckingham Palace announced that he would return to public engagements next week, and his first event will be a trip to a medical clinic focused on cancer with Queen Camilla. His Majesty the King will shortly return to public-facing duties after a period of treatment and recuperation following his recent cancer diagnosis, the palace statement read. To help mark this milestone, the King and Queen will make a joint visit to a cancer treatment center next Tuesday, where they will meet medical specialists and patients. This visit will be the first in a number of external engagements His Majesty will undertake in the weeks ahead. These engagements will include a state visit by Emperor Naruhito and Empress Masako of Japan, set to take place in June. The announcement came alongside the release of a new official portrait of the couple on their 19th wedding anniversary on April 10th. Taken by Millie Pilkingham, it shows the King and Queen walking in the gardens at Buckingham Palace. The palace statement also mentioned the upcoming anniversary of King Charles's 2023 coronation and thanked the public for their support since the big event. As the first anniversary of the coronation approaches, their majesties remain deeply grateful for the many kindnesses and good wishes they've received from around the world throughout the joys and challenges of the past year, it read. The king said that he would be taking a break from public duties when he announced his diagnosis with an unspecified form of cancer on February 5th. The cancer was discovered during a workup for the procedure to begin benign prostate cancer at the London clinic, though Vanity Fair confirmed at the time that the king was not suffering from prostate cancer. Though the king did not conduct any public engagement while he was undergoing outpatient treatment, he did continue to receive his daily red box delivery of government papers and also hosted small meetings at Buckingham Palace. Earlier this week, Vanity Fair reported that King had planned to resume public duties as soon as next month and that his treatment was going very well. At the moment, HRH is doing very well and responding well to treatment, the source said. He is very keen to get back to his public-facing duties before June if he can. He's doing well, but is frustrated more than anything else that he has to take time off. He's being a good patient, but not always a patient one. Next up in Hollywood, the sour smell of victory, Harvey Weinstein's legal win and the message that it sends. This is by Joy Press, published on April 26th. The overturn of Harvey Weinstein's New York rape conviction sends waves of nausea and resignation through the entertainment industry. One film executive who formerly worked with Weinstein viscerally recalls how she felt on the day in March 2020 when the disgraced movie mogul was sentenced to 23 years in prison. "I personally felt a lot of relief knowing that he was behind bars. I just felt safer moving through the world." Before the rise of Me Too, a film producer believed that a powerful man like Weinstein was unstoppable. He could do anything and break any rules. The conviction proved to her that, finally, there were consequences. Both women were horrified this week when they woke up to headlines announcing that the disgraced mogul's New York conviction had been overturned on appeal. It was like having the stitches ripped open in a monstrous wound. "There was a lot of hope and change in the air," the producer says, "and it kind of feels like we're backtracking. It feels to me now like the pendulum is swinging back the other way." The 2017 unearthing of Weinstein's grotesquely predatory behavior helped spark a mass exorcism that became #MeToo, and his New York trial was one of the first major criminal cases to emerge from the reckoning. More than 80 women eventually accused Weinstein of assault or misconduct, but the Manhattan case focused on just two: former aspiring actor Jessica Mann, who alleged that Weinstein raped her in 2013, and former Project Runway production assistant Miriam Haley, who alleged that he forcibly performed oral sex on her in 2006. Other women also testified during the trial to establish a pattern of bad behavior on Weinstein's part. They included actor Annabella Sciorra, who accused Weinstein of raping her in the early 90s and then harassing her for years afterward. Weinstein has long denied all the allegations the women have made against him. It was this testimony from additional women that contributed to the decision to overturn the verdict, according to the New York State Court of Appeals. "We conclude that the trial court erroneously admitted testimony of uncharged, alleged prior sexual acts against persons other than the complainants of the underlying crimes," the New York's highest court declared in the ruling. "I thought the approach that was taken by the prosecutors in the case really gave some life and meaning to the experiences of victims of sexual violence," says Anita Hill, who helped educate Americans about sexual harassment back in the day and is currently chair of the Hollywood Commission, which aims to end harassment and abuse in the entertainment industry. "Sexual assault is not a simple crime to prove, and it's nuanced in terms of the different ways that people respond to sexual violence. And so I thought bringing in other women to testify was very helpful. It humanized the people who were bringing up the suit and helped explain their behavior and response to the violence of the experience." Hill says that the testimonies of other women with similar experience provided important context in this case, because Weinstein was not just another creep. He was powerful enough that he could ensure accusers and those around him would stay silent. Weinstein's downfall rattled Hollywood enough to raise consciousness about sexual assault and put in place new systems for avoiding and reporting abuse. Many insiders believe that things have improved since the dawn of Me Too, but the Hollywood Commission's 2022-2023 survey of more than 5,200 entertainment industry workers found that there were still high rates of misconduct and that it was heavily underreported, as only 31% of respondents believed it is likely that a powerful harasser will be held accountable. Hill confirms that regardless of respondent demographics, there was never a category where a majority of people believed that a powerful man would be held responsible. "I think about something a veteran movie producer told me more than a year ago while discussing what had changed in Hollywood since Me Too. Men are afraid to behave badly because there have been enough situations where they are now suffering consequences," she said. "It would be nice if that wasn't the only motivation for behavior to improve, but I'll take it, you know." So what happens when a landmark case like Weinstein's goes up in smoke? Does the threat of consequences diminish? Not that the disgraced mogul will be taking off his prison uniform anytime soon. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office has vowed to do everything it can to retry the case, and Weinstein still has a 16-year sentence to serve for similar charges in Los Angeles, though he has filed a notice of appeal in California. Could Weinstein, avatar of the shitty media men who Me Too vowed to curb, end up walking free? The former Weinstein Company executive I spoke to is emotionally fried by this turn of events, but she's mostly disturbed by the idea of victims being made to testify again. To put all of these women through this all over again is just so traumatizing for them. I also can speak from expertise that once Weinstein is out of your life, you want to close that door forever. I ask Hill if she thinks the overturn of this landmark case will make victims less likely to come forward in the future. Every time there's a setback, we hear the same thing, that people will not come forward now, she says, and every time they do. Hill believes that outrage can help. Knowing that there is a public out there that actually does believe in justice for victims of sexual violence, that is helpful. I really wish that we didn't have to get the outcry in this particular way, but it can have a positive effect. This effort to end sexual violence is something that is ongoing, and we can't unsee the things that we've seen. A little media news with a personal column. Leaving CNN was how I found my voice. Former anchor Brooke Baldwin exited the network after 13 years, not because of Trump coverage or pandemic chaos, but because of something more ordinary and insidious. This is by Brooke Baldwin, published on April 23rd. I want to punch you in the face. Yes, those words actually came out of my mouth, like out loud, a couple months ago. I'm slightly embarrassed to admit that I was talking to my loving partner, Peter. He had just flown across the country and was set to wake up with me at 4-something in the morning so that he could accompany me to my appearance on Good Morning America. I was going back on national TV for the first time since I'd signed off from my CNN show. I'd be talking about the debut of my new Netflix show, The Trust. This was a big deal. In many ways, it felt like a rebirth. But that night before, I hadn't been in a celebratory mood. I was pissed off. I felt violent. I felt like I was going to explode. I am now in the process of understanding why, and this deep knowing has enabled me to change everything in my life. I am not an angry person. Or maybe I am. There I go, silencing myself again. When I signed off from CNN Newsroom on April 16, 2021, I couldn't tell the whole truth. I wasn't allowed to and probably still am not, but I'm now on the other side of a profound life moment of my unraveling. This story really begins during my senior year of college when my mother and I drove up to a strange house about a half hour from where I grew up in Atlanta. I was 21. Outside the house was my father's silver Porsche. Inside the house was my father, with a woman who was not my mother. I reached for the car door to run into the house or do or say I don't know what. With my leg dragging out the passenger door, I screamed at my mother to stop the car and let me out. Instead, she sped away, the passenger door slamming shut. Just recently, a friend told me my mom saved me that day. Had I gotten out of the car, I would have spent the rest of my life trying to unsee what I had seen. For years, I watched my mother keep her mouth shut. I held on to that secret and said nothing about or to my father. This would be just the beginning of carrying bigger secrets and allowing myself to be muzzled, or rather, as I'm now learning, muzzling myself. Ironic or not that I chose a career in TV journalism, which saw me wear a microphone to amplify the voices, voiceless, for a living. Problem was, I didn't use my own. I see it all so clearly now. I rarely spoke up for myself. CNN was always the dream. For 10 years, it put me in millions of living rooms, allowing me to cover everything from the White House to school shootings to the pandemic. I became known for giving you the news, straight up, with dignity and compassion. And after 10 years I spent climbing the ranks of local news to get to the big leagues, I was good at it. I was living my dream and saying yes to everything. Yes to oil spills. Yes to elections. Coal mine disasters. Hurricanes. Escaped inmates. Gun legislation. Yes to everything. Yes to everyone. I never said no. There would have always been someone hungrier and more telegenic if I had. Behind the scenes, my yes girl behavior was starting to snowball. CNN moved me from Atlanta to New York, but my producing team stayed behind. We would work long distance. I could feel my tether to my executive producer begin to fray. It wasn't always like this. In fact, those first few years working together were pretty great. We bounced ideas off each other. We got excited about similar news stories. I adored his wife and kids, and he always knew whom I was dating. Our relationship was almost as sibling-like as it was collegial. But after my move, our working relationship started to take a drastic turn. My producer made me feel as though I couldn't do heavy-hitting interviews without him. Or maybe I allowed him to make it feel like I couldn't do heavy-hitting interviews without him. The word gaslighting has become so cliche, but that's what it felt like. Manipulation, bullying. Anyone who's ever tried long distance in any kind of relationship, romantic or professional, knows that it wears on you. My producer was read in on the news at all times. It was his job. When you work at any cable news network, email comes in fast and furiously. Sometimes that meant I would accidentally miss his emails, and I started to notice that if I didn't respond to those emails right away, he would go dark. Even worse, sometimes he would go dark during my live broadcasts, in front of hundreds and thousands of people. There would be days when I'd get on set, clip on my microphone, and slip my earpiece into my right ear. No hello, no check-in. Instead, I'd be greeted by someone less seasoned. With live TV, there should always be a palpable sense of I've got you, which goes both ways between anchor and executive producer. I had to learn how to rely on myself and others to move through the show without him. Sometimes he needed to communicate urgently with me. For instance, if he had gotten word there'd be a press conference and wanted me to know I'd need to ad lib coming out of it. But depending on his mood, he might refuse to actually speak into my ear, instead writing me notes on the teleprompter during commercial breaks. I got into a bad habit. I never picked up the phone and said something, like really said something, not to him, and I didn't report up the chain of command. I was the good girl. Good girls smile, are grateful for our jobs, and keep our mouths shut. We definitely don't speak up. Everything changed for me the day in 2015 when Donald Trump came down that escalator. In the years that followed, I was not only pushed out of alignment with what had become and how I was being told to cover it, I was also changed. I got curious about the legions of women who, as a direct result of that election, finally decided to speak up. In 2018, I started researching my book, Huddle, about the collective power of women. I spent weekends during one of the most insane news cycles of our lifetime interviewing black women judges in Texas, a queer chef from San Francisco, military badasses turned congresswomen, athletes, teachers, activists, mothers, women who knew real marginalization and discrimination. I'm a privileged white woman, and yet that's when I started to find my voice. No, I don't want to cover that today. No, I'd like to interview her instead of him. No, I will not be spoken to like that. Despite my own narrative that I needed my producer, I knew I needed to figure it out without him, and I knew that I could. In November 2019, I finally walked into my boss's office. I told Jeff Zucker, the former president of CNN, that I wanted my producer off my team. I didn't want him to be punished, just move to another anchor to start new. A male colleague had made a similar request with success. My request? Denied. Little did I know this was the beginning of the end for me. A few weeks later, I got called back into the boss's office with my then agent, who'd prepped me with something like, "Brooke, your boss is furious at you. What have you done?" I'd had a lovely relationship with Jeff up until this point. I'd even danced with him at my wedding. And now I found myself standing in his office dumbfounded, but prepared to defend myself and my integrity. I couldn't help but wonder, why was I even sitting here? Why did I suddenly feel like the third wheel with my executive producer and my boss? Had I inadvertently kicked a hornet's nest? All because I'd gone over my producer's head to the big boss? It didn't make sense. I wasn't accusing this guy of any kind of misconduct. Just as I told Jeff, our working relationship had kind of run out of track. Instead of addressing me right away, my boss engaged in the longest 5-minute conversation of my life, not with me, but with my agent. The topic, whether Anderson Cooper, another of her clients, was happy with the view out of his new office. I stood there waiting to hear my fate. What the fucking fuck? Textbook power move. I just stood there, paralyzed, in fear, in shame. And then Jeff turned to me and threatened, "I could give your show to someone in Washington tomorrow." Long pause. "But I won't, because I believe you're the best broadcaster on this network." He told me that I needed my executive producer and that he would not remove him. Whiplash, instability, another classic play. I'd lost. Some months later, the pandemic hit. I got a severe case of COVID early, and my sickness became national news. I was getting alerts about myself. Thousands of viewers reached out to me and showed me so much love, but what they didn't know was that in addition to my health, I was fighting for my own self-respect. To summarize the next year, with very little explanation, read some excuse about not enough available control rooms to produce my show, my boss yanked me off the air for the 2 months leading up to and including Election Day 2020. When people understandably started asking why I was taking vacation during such a crucial time, I responded to a random buried comment on Instagram, "Not my choice." My three little words made news around the globe, so I got slapped again. When my show got back on, Jeff cut it in half. This time I kept my mouth shut. "Be grateful," Jeff had once told me over lunch a year or two before while we were in contract negotiations. "Don't be like Megyn Kelly. Don't you dare get bored." Why did I leave? Didn't I leave earlier? For one thing, that little girl deep inside of me would have been so disappointed. She and I, we lived in small-town West Virginia. We dated the wrong guys. We put off having kids. The hustling. We can't quit now. We worked too hard for this. This was our dream. CNN beat me to it. In January 2021, the morning Trump was impeached for a second time, my cell phone rang, and it wasn't my boss. Rather, it was my agent. Jeff wanted me out. No explanation, just out. From that moment on, after I'd spent 13 years at CNN, Jeff never spoke to me again. Neither did my former executive producer, who ended up getting moved to another show for COVID protocol reasons and then eventually promoted. When I emailed them to let them know I'd be publishing this piece, offering each of them a chance to comment on or dispute my recollections, Jeff's publicist responded by saying that he wishes you all the best. My old producer never responded. After 10 years, crickets. And the worst part? I had to lie to my team, my friends and family, and my viewers. My lawyer and publicist worked hard to negotiate my exit, fighting to allow me to announce my news on my own show. In February, I got to do exactly that. My end date was mutually agreed upon, coincidentally coming less than 2 weeks after I would be publishing my first book. Eventually, I did an interview with the Ms. Magazine podcast, during which I called out gender inequality at CNN. Another phone call from my agent, another "Jeff is going nuclear." This time, he was apparently threatening to yank me off the air. My response? "But he's already yanking me off the air." My then agent: "He is threatening to yank you even sooner." He didn't. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about a former CNN agent turned author. Let's continue. Through my final days at CNN, I was so allergic to the idea that that instead of risking running into him on the way to the bathroom, I contemplated peeing in a Gatorade bottle in my office. Everything was upside down. On my last day at the network, after I said goodbyes, I slipped out the literal side door of the building and of my dream. On my way out, the only CNN face I saw was a security guard's. Masked, hands trembling, Anthony stood there clutching a shoebox. He'd bought me a pair of Air Jordans as a goodbye. I hugged him and wept. No cheesy plaque, no champagne, no send-off party, just quiet. Life is unfair. People are shitty. Bosses are bullies. This is not news. And the hierarchy of giving a shit, I didn't think my story, my thousand little cuts, amounted to much. It's taken me nearly 3 years to remove the blinders, feel the anger, welcome the fear, and recognize that in all my yeses, in all my silence, in all my enabling, the person who betrayed me the most was me. I wanted to obey. I wanted to please. I wanted to be the good girl. I was afraid they'd let me go. Joke's on me. It starts in childhood. We want approval from our parents, then our lovers, then our bosses. I wanted the people who had the certain control over me to want me so that I could get what I wanted. It's a transaction and it's a gamble, and the house always wins. A former colleague of mine in her 20s knew what I was going through at work. She confessed to me later that she was aghast and afraid. If it could happen to me, how would it not happen to her? Which brings me back to wanting to punch my man in the face. Why was I so angry? Because all of the truths were flooding into my mind the night before GMA. The muzzling, the charade, my childhood, my accountability. I didn't hit Peter, of course. Instead, he threw his arms around me, showing me how to feel seen and safe, and I wept. I wept for my mother. I wept for the versions of a woman I'd been throughout my life. I wept for the woman I was finally becoming. So this is my confession. I'm calling myself out, and it feels powerful. As for my family, my mother eventually left my father. She's found love with a man, a kind of love that she had never known. And I don't speak to my father, who was remarried. I wish him well. Part of my own unraveling meant I became a believer in divorce, including my divorce, so to speak, from CNN. Like my marriage ending, it was painful. I miss being a vessel for information and clarity and news, the good and the bad. I miss my audience, but I'm experiencing a rebirth. As a forest fire, you can burn out the debris and foster new growth. And it turns out that once you find your voice, you can't unfind it. You can still say yes, as long as it's using that voice. Yes to hosting a social experiment show on Netflix. Yes to becoming a filmmaker, my own storyteller. Yes to getting divorced. Yes to starting the fuck over. Yes to finding new love. Yes to chopping your hair. Remove your armor. Burn the boats. Unraveling, a funny word. I always took it to mean coming apart, but it can also mean getting to the truth. Now I realize it's both. Moving from Hollywood to politics, I present Nerd Prom. Hollywood descends upon DC as Scarlett Johansson, Divine Joy Randolph, and other stars attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner. This is by Eve Beatty, published on April 28th. The White House Correspondents' Dinner delivered when it came to glitz and glamour on Saturday with a red carpet lineup that included a diverse lineup of journalists, political figures, and celebrities. Looking for a legendary superhero? Here's Wonder Woman's Linda Carter. How about a pair of 1980s icons? There's Molly Ringwald and her Pretty in Pink co-star, Andrew McCarthy. Oh, and President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris were there too. The annual event is intended to provide a humorous break from the daily cutthroat grind of political reporting and to celebrate the joys of a free press. This year, the confluence of journalism and celebrity also attracted protesters against the war between Israel and Hamas. "Shame on you," some demonstrators cried as stars including Billy Porter, Chris Pine, and Scarlett Johansson entered the Washington Hilton Hotel. "Western media, we see you and all the horrors that you hide," CBS quotes the protesters as chanting. Kerry Russell and Rufus Sewell were also there, perhaps a reminder that season 2 of The Diplomat is on the way. So were John Hamm, who has lent his voice to efforts to unseat Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, and Sean Penn, who once characterized a mugshot of presidential candidate Donald Trump as angry used car salesman, failed magician in Vegas. But while Hamm and Penn eschewed the red carpet, many others stopped to pose, including Rosario Dawson, Fran Drescher, Divine Joy Randolph, Rachel Brosnahan, and Hirokui Sanada. Moving into the politics section, Republicans add fuel to the fire as student arrests sweep college campuses. This is by Eric Lutz, published on April 25th. Tensions have been boiling over at American universities for more than a week now as protests over the war in Gaza continue to spread on campuses across the country. But Republican leaders are turning up the temperature with increasingly extreme rhetoric, intent, it seems, on escalating an already fraught situation. During a visit Wednesday to Columbia University, House Speaker Mike Johnson called on President Joe Biden to send in National Guard troops if pro-Palestinian demonstrations weren't contained, echoing earlier calls by Mitch McConnell and other top Republicans to quash the protests by force. "This is dangerous," Johnson said, as hecklers booed and chanted. "Go back to class and stop the nonsense," he told student protesters who have been encamped at Columbia since last Wednesday. "Stop wasting your parents' money." Meanwhile, as Johnson antagonized student activists in New York, Greg Abbott was deploying state troopers to the University of Texas at Austin, where nearly 60 demonstrators were arrested after 500 students walked out in protest of the school's financial ties to Israel. "These protesters belong in jail," Abbott said of the demonstration. "Students joining in hate-filled, anti-Semitic protests at any public college or university in Texas should be expelled." Donald Trump, never one to miss an opportunity to score political points, also decried the demonstrations Wednesday, likening the anti-war activists to the white supremacists who marched on Charlottesville, Virginia, during the first year of his presidency. "Charlottesville is like a peanut compared to the riots and anti-Israel protests that are happening all over our country," Trump insisted. The comparison is hardly justified, of course. Charlottesville's Unite the Right rally, which was organized by neo-Nazi and far-right militias, resulted in one death and almost 40 injuries when a white supremacist drove a car through a throng of peaceful counter-protesters. This week's demonstrations, by contrast, have involved no significant or widespread physical violence by activists, though there have been more notable incidents of harassment and intimidation that raise legitimate concerns about an anti-Semitic contingent of the movement. Biden, who has repeatedly maintained ironclad support for Israel, despite mounting Democratic criticism over the war, which has resulted in the deaths of over 34 Palestinians, has explicitly condemned those anti-Semitic incidents, as have others in his orbit. "No student should live in fear on campus," Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff wrote last weekend after several Jewish students at Columbia were targeted with harassment by some pro-Palestinian protesters. "Colleges and universities, along with their leadership, must do better." All of this, however, is no object for Trump and his allies, many of whom are defining the demonstrations by certain instances of harassment, conflating any criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, and further inflaming what's already a tense conflict. Republicans are cynically, brutally escalating for their own political advantage, as Indivisible's Leah Greenberg put it Thursday. They want to crack down on protest and dissent and flex their power to go after college kids. The GOP's rhetoric is not just cynical but dangerous and calls to mind the extreme crackdown on Vietnam War protests outside Chicago's Democratic Convention in 1968 and at Kent State in 1970, the latter of which ended with 4 dead and 9 wounded after the Ohio National Guard fired on the crowd of students. "We must not repeat the horrors of Kent State 54 years later," Laurel Krauss, the sister of one of the students killed in that massacre, said in response to university efforts to quell the protests. Indeed, many school responses have been over the top, counterproductive, and have only led to more upset. And it goes without saying that the GOP's attempts to capitalize on that unrest may only make matters worse. It's a complete clown show, Representative Ilhan Omar, whose daughter was suspended for participating in the Columbia protest, said on MSNBC after Johnson's appearance at Columbia. "These people do not care about violent protests. They don't care about the First Amendment. They care about performing their political theater." Let's get caught up on the Trump trial. David Pecker's Testimony and the Long Life of a Media Bromance. This is by Dan Adler, published on the 26th. David Pecker appears to be in a breezy mood this week. The former National Enquirer publisher was describing the inner workings of his trade, checkbook journalism, he called it on Monday, without needing much prompting from the district attorney who was questioning him. Pecker, a longtime friend and ally of Donald Trump's, was the first state's witness in the former president's Manhattan trial that began last week, and while he was on the stand, he often turned to the jury to gesticulate. The only thing that's important, Pecker said with a proud air of authority, is the cover of the magazine. Trump is accused of falsifying business records, charges which he has pleaded not guilty to and which, in the strict sense that this lead lawyer, Todd Blanche, invoked in his opening statement earlier that day, amount to a matter of paperwork. But the prosecution is seeking to paint a broader picture of how these records were used to cover up an alleged affair with the porn star Stormy Daniels, which Trump has denied, and related interference in the 2016 presidential election. And in these early days of a trial that is expected to last 6 weeks, the case has accrued some narrative flourish, taking jurors into the almost comically sordid world of supermarket tabloids and a man who has loomed large over them. Pecker and Trump met in the late 80s. They were both outer borough-born aspirants, though Pecker, the Bronx son of a bricklayer, grew up with considerably less means. He started out as an accountant, but made a mark in media when, while working as president of magazine publisher Hachette, he invested in the short-lived and briefly celebrated politics lifestyle magazine George, launched by JFK Jr. in 1995. During an early visit to Mar-a-Lago to pitch advertisers, he saw Trump's then-wife. "I have never in my life seen a more beautiful woman in a bodysuit than Marla Maples," Pecker told The New Yorker in 2017. "I mean, seriously, out of 10, she was a 15. The pair's kinship developed into a business partnership when Pecker proposed starting Trump Style, a magazine for guests at the future president's properties. In 1999, Pecker and a group of investors acquired American Media, which owned The Inquirer. The tabloid's audience followed Trump religiously, Pecker testified this week with his hair combed back and a thick mustache. By 2003, he was a member at Mar-a-Lago, where he attended Trump's wedding to Melania Knaus 2 years later. "The press surrounding The Apprentice," he said, "and the incredible ratings that The Celebrity Apprentice had were a boon for him, too." Pecker stepped down as CEO of AMI in 2020, essentially ending his empire. His testimony this week has given him a chance to explain for a rapt audience, including an international press corps, how he reached the media heights that he did. "The Inquirer got its stories," Pecker said, "by cultivating sources at the fringes of celebrity, limo drivers, hotel workers. Any stories costing more than $10,000 would require his sign-off." Some of his testimony embodied the "saying the quiet part out loud" trope. In describing how Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, fed him tips for stories on the candidate's political rivals in the lead-up to the 2016 election, Pecker said, "That was the basis of our story, and then we would embellish it from there." "Bungling surgeon Ben Carson left sponge in patient's brain," read one representative headline displayed for the jury. The coziness between Cohen, Pecker, and Trump is at the heart of the case. In 2015, a meeting at Trump Tower in Manhattan, prosecutor Matthew Colangelo said in his opening statement, "Those three men formed a conspiracy." Pecker elaborated in his testimony. "I was the one who thought a lot of women would come out and try to sell their stories," Pecker said, with Trump occasionally gazing over at him. "Mr. Trump was well known as the most eligible bachelor and dated the most beautiful women," Trump and Cohen asked Pecker. He said what he and his magazines could do to help the campaign. After they met for about 20 to 25 minutes, he went on, they reached an agreement among friends. Pecker would act as the eyes and ears of the campaign, alert to any stories about Trump on the marketplace. "Holy shit, I thought Pecker would be the last one to turn," a friend of Trump's told Vanity Fair in 2018 when the news broke that the publisher, who would receive immunity from prosecution, had agreed to cooperate with authorities. Pecker said on Thursday that Trump called him very upset when the first hush money payment related to the case, an agreement between AMI and Karen McDougal, a former Playboy model who has claimed to have an affair with Trump, came to light just before the 2016 election. Trump has denied the affair. "I thought you had this under control," he said, according to Pecker, and hung up without saying goodbye. Still, their relationship had seemed to withstand even Pecker's gregarious testimony this week. On Thursday morning, before heading to the trial, Trump made a campaign stop at a Manhattan construction site where he hoisted a welding mask, told reporters that David's been very nice, and called him a nice guy. This, prosecutors argued after he arrived at the courthouse, consisted a violation of his gag order insofar as it communicated to witnesses that they needed to be nice or else risk his Truth Social wrath. A few hours later, Pecker described Trump on the stand as his mentor. Passing by their table during a break in the proceedings, he flashed the defendant and his lawyers a toothy grin. A little Arizona politics, Carrie Lake and the GOP's clumsy messaging about abortion. This is by Eric Lutz, published on the 24th. Earlier this month, Carrie Lake, the right-wing candidate running for the United States Senate in Arizona, tried to distance herself from the Civil War-era abortion ban on the state's high court upheld. "It's abundantly clear," the MAGA candidate said in a statement at the time, "that this pre-statehood law is out of step with Arizonans." But in a recent interview, Lake sounded a different note, expressing frustration that the 1864 law has yet to be enforced by state leaders. "The Arizona Supreme Court said this is the law of Arizona, but unfortunately, the people running our state have said that they're not going to enforce it. We don't have that law, as many of us wish we did," she said during the visit to Idaho, which is at the center of the first major abortion case before the U.S. Supreme Court since its conservative majority overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. Lake's remarks came as Arizona Democrats mounted a third push to repeal the 1864 ban after previous efforts were thwarted by state Republicans, underscoring the deceitfulness of the GOP's efforts to clean up the abortion mess they made. But Lake isn't the only conservative trying to have it both ways on reproductive rights or to muddy the issue ahead of the November election. The Republican Party has tried to fix its brand problem on reproductive rights by discussing the issue with more common sense and empathy, as the Wall Street Journal reported last month, as its leader Donald Trump has sought to reframe abortion as a matter of states' rights. "It's tailor-made," Trump said of differing state abortion laws in an interview with Philadelphia's Action News on Tuesday, during a break in his Manhattan criminal trial. "It's really working out well for people," Trump said, "and they're very, very happy." In reality, the state of reproductive health care in America has weighed down Republicans in post-Dobbs elections, in which voters, who overwhelmingly support abortion protections, have rejected both draconian restrictions and anti-choice extremists, which is why Trump and his fellow Republicans are so desperate to obfuscate their position. "Donald Trump is worried voters are going to hold him accountable," President Joe Biden said during a campaign stop in Florida, where the 6-week abortion ban Governor Ron DeSantis signed last year is set to take effect May 1st. "Look, I don't think we're going to let them get away with it." Holding Trump and the GOP accountable in November will require Biden and the Democrats to continue hammering on the issue. Though Democrats mobilize voters on abortion in the midterms and off-year elections, the dynamics of the presidential election could be different, as Rachel M. Cohen pointed out in Vox last month. Where midterms and special elections tend to draw highly engaged voters, presidential elections also bring out less engaged voters who may not view Trump as the threat to abortion rights that he is, even though he has rightfully claimed credit for the fall of Roe. That's precisely the kind of confusion Trump and Republicans are trying to foster with their misleading, inconsistent rhetoric on abortion. The task ahead for Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and their surrogates is to break through the noise. There's one person responsible for this nightmare, and he's acknowledged, and he brags about it, Biden said in Tampa on Tuesday, Donald Trump. We're moving to the best 11 section, and this is also about Arizona. Trump escapes Arizona felony charges. The same can't be said for his pals. This was published on the 25th. Remember the 2020 election and how Donald Trump decisively lost to Joe Biden, but he couldn't accept said loss and instead conspired with his cronies to try and steal a second term in schemes that included fake elector plots in several states? Well, more than 3 years later, some of those cronies are being held accountable by the state of Arizona. An Arizona grand jury has indicted 18 individuals for trying to overturn the election in the state, including 7 people who worked for or were affiliated with Trump. Those people include former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, attorneys Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, John Eastman, and Christina Bobb, 2020 and 2016 and 2024 campaign advisor Boris Efstein, and 2020 campaign aide Mike Roman. In Arizona and the United States, the people elected Joseph Biden as president on November 3rd, 2020, reads the indictment, which was announced on Wednesday. Unwilling to accept this fact, defendants and unindicted co-conspirators schemed to prevent the lawful transfer of presidency to keep Trump in power against the will of Arizona voters. This scheme would have deprived Arizona voters of their right to vote and have their votes counted. According to the Washington Post, all defendants appear to have been charged with every crime laid out in the indictment. Those felonies are conspiracy, fraudulent schemes and practices, fraudulent schemes and artifices, and forgery. Fraudulent schemes and artifices, the most serious of all the crimes, comes with a standard 5-year prison sentence. In a statement, Attorney General Chris Mays said the charges resulted from a thorough 13-month investigation, adding, "I will not allow American democracy to be undermined. It is too important." While Trump himself was not charged, he shows up as a major player in the scheme. Per the Post, many of those involved in the 2020 elector strategy, which played out in Arizona and 6 other states, have long insisted that the tactic was legal because the Trump electors, who were only placeholders to be activated if legal challenges to Biden's win were successful in court. But Mays charges that Trump's allies inside and outside of Arizona intended all along to use the electors to falsely claim that the outcome of the election was in doubt, facilitating an effort to obstruct the certification of Biden's victory in Congress on January 6, 2021. The effort was aided by Trump, the indictment said, who himself was unwilling to accept that he had lost the election. While the charges focus on that elector strategy, the indictment spells out various ways that Trump and his allies sought to pressure state and local officials to encourage them to change the election results. Trump allies initially put pressure on members of the Phoenix area Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, the indictment said. When it became clear that the GOP-led board would not alter the results, pressure was placed on members of the state legislature, namely then House Speaker Rusty Bowers, Republican, who heard from Trump and other allies. When that effort failed, Trump sought to appeal to then-Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, who ignored a call from Trump while certifying the state's election results. That day, the indictment notes, Trump berated Ducey on social media for certifying the results. This is not the first time Meadows, Giuliani, Ellis, Eastman, and Roman have been hit with felony charges for trying to overturn the election, having been indicted last year by the district attorney's office in Fulton County, Georgia, which also charged Trump. In that case, Ellis pleaded guilty and has been cooperating with the DA. The other individuals have pleaded not guilty. Following the Arizona charges, an attorney for Meadows said he had not yet seen the indictment, but that if his client was charged, it is a blatantly political and politicized accusation and will be contested and defeated. A lawyer for Eastman said his client is innocent of criminal conduct in Arizona or any other place and will fight these charges as he has all the other unjust accusations leveled against him. A spokesman for Giuliani claimed the indictment is evidence of the continued weaponization of our justice system. Epstein declined the Post's request for comment. Bob and attorneys for Roman and Ellis did not immediately respond. A spokesperson for Trump called the indictment another example of Democrats' weaponization of the legal system. Next Levin Report headline, Donald Trump accepts Bill Barr's endorsement by implying he's a tub of lard. This is published on the 26th. Former Attorney General Bill Barr has spent the past 3 years telling anyone who will listen that Donald Trump is an egomaniac and a brazen criminal who's responsible for January 6th and not fit to hold office. So it was pretty pathetic, though not actually surprising, when Barr said last week that he would vote for the Republican, aka Trump, in November. Even more pathetic and humiliating, that Trump responded to the news by basically calling Barr a tub of lard. Taking to Truth Social, Trump told his followers, "Wow, former AG Bill Barr, who let a lot of great people down by not investigating voter fraud in our country, has just endorsed me for president despite the fact that I called him weak, slow-moving, lethargic, gutless, and lazy." New York Post, "Based on the fact that I greatly appreciated his wholehearted endorsement, I am removing the word lethargic from my statement. Thank you, Bill, MAGA 2024. As New York Magazine notes, this was Trump's not at all subtle way of calling Barr fat, because if the former president of the United States is one thing, it is a schoolyard bully. The former AG, of course, does not deserve anyone's sympathy. Having worked closely with Trump while doing his dirty work, he should have seen this coming. Barr effectively endorsed Trump last week when he told Fox News, "I think it's my duty to pick the person I think would do the least harm to the country. And in my mind, that's, I will vote the Republican ticket." Incredibly, during an interview in December, Barr warned that it would be extremely difficult to get Trump to do the right thing in a second term, as he wouldn't have another election to worry about. "Trump needs people around him who will push back and help keep him on the straight and narrow," Barr said. "During his first term, the main way this could be done is by pointing out to him how this would hurt his prospects for a second term. Once he wins a second term, I don't know, you know, what considerations can be used to push back against bad ideas." Of course, during the more recent interview, he added that the real danger to the country is the progressive agenda, not the guy who tried to steal an election and needs to be reminded to do the right thing. And our last headline, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito argues presidents must be allowed to commit federal crimes or democracy as we know it will be over. Incredible logic from the conservative wing of the court. This is published on the 25th. On Thursday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments for and against Donald Trump's claim of absolute presidential immunity. The good news is that the court appeared unlikely to just completely rule in his favor, agree that he should not face prosecution for anything he did in office, and kill the federal election case against him. The bad news is that, unsurprisingly, they're not just going to tell him to fuck off, as some justices suggested that presidents should receive some immunity, a move that would potentially limit special counsel Jack Smith's case and delay a trial until after the November election. The insane news? That conservative justice Samuel Alito literally tried to argue that we should allow presidents to commit crimes without fear of prosecution in order to save democracy. That's right. Speaking to Michael Dreeben, an attorney representing the special counsel, Alito began by stating, "I'm sure you would agree with me that a stable democratic society, requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully if that candidate is the incumbent." Then, having started with a premise that all reasonable people would agree with, he went in with this. "If an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy?" If your brain hurts from trying to follow that, what Alito is saying here is that presidents need to know that they'll never be prosecuted for any crimes they might commit in office, or democracy will collapse because future office holders might, say, try to overturn a free and fair election in order to stay in power and avoid criminal charges. And if that sounds completely absurd to you, you're not alone. Responding to Alito's hypothetical, Dreeben said, "I think it's exactly the opposite, Justice Alito." Alito's desire to literally let presidents do anything they want could, of course, lead to terrible outcomes, which liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor unfortunately had to point out. Anyway, it's obviously good news that the court is unlikely to endorse Trump and seemingly Alito's claims that presidents should enjoy absolute immunity for anything they do in office. But it's really, really quite bad that the likely outcome of the proceedings will still be a huge win for the ex-president. Per the New York Times, there did not seem to be a lot of urgency among the justices, especially the conservative ones, to ensure that the immunity question was resolved quickly. That left open the possibility that Mr. Trump could avoid being tried on charges of plotting to overturn the last election until well after voters went to the polls to decide whether to choose him as president in this election. And if he is elected president, all of this will obviously go away. Whew, this brings us to the end of our time together. Once again, you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you for listening and have a great week, everybody.